Let's come to order here. We'll be doing the Hennepin County presentation first. If you want to start gathering, that would be great. We are going to learn a lot about coordinated care today and about community health centers. And we could actually spend, I always say this, but if they want to come down, if Hennepin County people want to come down and just get prepared for whatever they're going to say. But it's fascinating. I've had the privilege of touring their clinic over there. I had a strange discovery yesterday that everybody doesn't listen to our committee every day, and I can't believe that there are people in the industry who are not tuning into this every time we meet. And that was a shock to me. But someone didn't know that we'd appointed a new study group on the special transportation consisting of Representative Fritz and Representative McDonald. And so, if there's anything else you haven't heard, let me know what it is you don't know, and I'll be happy to repeat the announcement. Anyway, that's just meant to be a joke. But anyway, so, and for those who haven't heard anything, we have 10 study groups on most major topics. And if you're on one of those groups or interested in talking to one of those groups about your particular topic, if you're the public or a lobbyist or have an interest in trying to craft our policy as we face these incredible budget challenges, now is a good time to do that. They need to get back to me with what concepts they're thinking of in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And they're meant to be functional and real. It's just a way to kind of break out your topic in a little smaller way. So if anybody doesn't have those lists, Andy, my CLA, can get you those. So anyway, welcome. I'm looking forward to a fascinating discussion today. Commissioner Opat, welcome. And welcome to both of you, Doctor. And are you going to kick it off? And
yeah, Mr. Okay. Chairman, thank you for the invitation. My name is Mike Opat. I'm the chair of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners. I'm also a member of the Hennepin Health System Board, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but I am here with two roles. Mr. Chairman, two things. First off, I'm always astonished people don't watch the county board meetings on Channel 6 either. So I completely understand.
What is that here. About?
I don't know. What are they doing with their lives anyway? We cure insomnia like nobody else in this place. The second thing I want to do is just thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your attendance at our delegation meeting that we had. The Hennepin delegation, Hennepin is not in your district, but you thought enough of us to come by. We held it at the Hennepin County Medical Center because the issues around the medical center are so profound to us, and you spent an evening with us, and we appreciate it. And I know you are knowledgeable about this issue and had some of the tours and some of the background, so you'll be getting a refresher. I'm just going to make a couple introductory comments and hand off to Dr. Johnson and Mr. Harrisall and others here who can talk about our experience with the CCDS. But first, the context for the CCDS goes like this. The Hennepin County Medical Center is the county's largest enterprise. It's the largest thing we own. While the county board doesn't operate it anymore on a day-to-day basis, we have an operating board that the legislature authorized a couple years ago and has been working very well for us. Myself and Commissioner Callison now sit on that operating board and participate in the decisions that happen there. Just a refresher, the Hennepin County Medical Center is Minnesota's largest public teaching hospital. We're a major safety net hospital for Hennepin County and areas beyond. We operate the Poison Control Center for the entire state. We do hyperbaric medicine for the and have a chamber there for emergency situations. And every time you hear about a carbon monoxide emergency where people are airlifted to town, it's usually they're going to do a little time in the hyperbaric chamber and receive that specialized care. We provide care to the poorest of the poor, whether that's families or whether that's single adults, and that's mostly who we're going to be talking about today. The other important thing to remember is, and I know you understand it, but let me just say it to make sure I touch all the bases here, is that as this kind of a hospital and clinic system, we rely on public pay programs more than the private hospitals do. When you have commercial paying patients, you can hold your own and make money. When you have public paying patients, you're going to lose money. And that's the nature of how the reimbursements go. Why that matters is then the Hennepin County Board subsidizes Hennepin County Medical Center on average about $25 to $30 million a year from the property tax. That's not our choice, and we do our best to lean on the hospital management to keep that number low, but that's the facts of life when you run a public teaching hospital and support it and support its mission. So we got into the CCDS not really by choice, but by virtue of the fact that something is better than nothing. So when I, in my role as chair of the board last year, was negotiating with then Commissioner Ludeman after following the elimination of GAMC and talking over the concept of the CCDS, ultimately our choice and our gamble, if you will, was that we would take the risk of the CCDS patients, do our best to provide a care in a different model, understand that we were putting ourselves at risk by doing this, but along with talking very closely with the other three hospital systems, we would go ahead and do that after some significant negotiations we did that. So our experience has been that we lose money. We get some reimbursement, but these are difficult patients, and I'll let Dr. Johnson talk a little bit about that. They're very expensive to take care of. They're very frequent users of health care. They're very high needs people. And we will welcome a new day when there's payment reform, and we are open to any pilot. But right now, the backstop is the property tax, and that's something that no one on this committee, although there's no one here from Hennepin County, we'd ask you not to forget. So with that, Mr. Chairman, unless you have any, if there are no questions of me, I'll stand down and let the folks who know the details step in.
Yeah, that sounds great, and I commended you at the time, and I'll recommend you for taking the risk to engage in this very important thing. Dr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. You actually got about 10 minutes, so we're going to have each of the different sites do about 10 minutes on what they learned, and good luck with fitting that schedule. So, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself.
I'm Dr. Paul Johnson. I'm a staff physician at Hennepin County Medical Center, where I've made my career over the last 16 years serving Minneapolis's and the Twin Cities underserved. And I've been involved in the leadership of the CCDS, and I'm medical director of the ambulatory ICU, which I'm going to tell you about shortly, which is one of our innovations. Pam, I'll let you introduce yourself.
I'm Pam Clifford at Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm the director for the Center for Healthcare Innovation. I've been working very closely with Dr. Johnson and other members of HCMC's medical staff and supporting staff to develop and implement this program for our patients. And there have been some wonderful learnings from it, which Dr. Johnson will tell you more about.
As you all know, the story of CCDS begins last year when the General Assistance Medical Care Program was unallotted and in place. A number of hospital systems around the state were offered block grant opportunities to provide care for former GA recipients. Hennepin County Medical Center stepped forward to fill this void for our patients. I just have to re-echo what Commissioner Opat said, that this was a spectacularly bad business decision. We received about $30 million to provide care, which previously we had billed about $90 million, and that's already being paid previously at underpaid Medicaid rates. So it really has been a big financial loss for the institution. We think that probably over the year we've lost something like $20 million serving this population. I can say, though, and this is the flip side of the coin, that this is probably the best $20 million we've ever lost at Hennepin County Medical Center, because we've learned a lot, and that's really what I want to talk about here. The CCDS has become the engine of innovation at our hospital. We've seen things happening at HCMC that we've not seen before, and it's really been quite remarkable. As we sort of stood back last spring and said, what the heck are we going to do with all this lack of money, we said we have to do things better. We have to provide better value for the money that we're getting. And we looked at our population and we said, we have different kinds of patients here. Let's treat them differently. We have what we call Tier 1 patients who we put into our medical home model. We have Tier 2 patients who are the sometimes sick. They get hospitalized once or twice a year, and we try to prevent them from being rehospitalized. And then we have Tier 3 patients, who I'm going to tell you about a little bit more later. They are the sickest of the sick, and they require really overhaul of their healthcare system and healthcare delivery. And we've done some very good work about that. I'm going to tell you about that briefly. Just to touch briefly on what's gone on in Tier 1, which is really our medical home. One of the issues we see in that arena is mental health problems. mental health problems are endemic in this population. In the historical accounts of the general assistance population, the GA population was about 15 times more likely to have an inpatient mental health admission than the Minnesota care population. So there's tremendous need in this population. As you know, there are not enough mental health providers in the Twin Cities. Anywhere nationally, there are not enough. The CCDS program responded to this at Hennepin by hiring four new mental health providers, but also we've instituted a triage system for referrals around mental health services. This new system, along with new providers and triage function, is going to serve as the backbone of our renovating our mental health system and integrating mental health services into primary care. We'll be more cost effective, more efficient, more patient friendly. So we're very excited about that work on Tier 1 in our medical homes. I'll turn briefly now to Tier 2, which those are care interventions that we have for anyone who becomes hospitalized in our hospital. I'm currently working on the inpatient service at Hennepin. I tell my residents every single day that the most dangerous day in the hospital is the first day patients aren't there. Readmissions are a terrible problem. They are an avoidable medical expense. We need to do better as a profession around this. Readmission rates to the hospitals nationally and all payers tend to range between 15 and 30%. When we looked at this last spring, we said we can't have this happening. We instituted a multidisciplinary discharge planning process. We partnered with the Minnesota visiting nurse to see our patients in rapid follow-up and arranged for short-term follow-up in our clinic systems. We think this combination of efforts has reduced readmissions possibly as much as 50% in our CCDS population and given us substantial cost savings. I'm going to turn now and talk just a little bit about the Tier 3 experience that we've had. That's what we've now grown to call our ambulatory ICU. As you all know who are students of healthcare, there's in every payment structure out there, there's a small tip of the iceberg population on which a tremendous amount of resources are spent. That happens in Medicare, it happens in Medicaid, it happens in private payers. It's everywhere in healthcare. We think in our CCDS population that probably 3% of the users of our hospital in this system account for about half of the costs. And so we said we need to do something different for this population. These are the sickest of the sick. They're most complex. When I see these people and they come to me in the clinic, all I can do is throw up my hands. I, as a single clinician, you cannot take care of these people. You don't have the resources. You really have no way to approach their complex problems. So what we've done at Hennepin is to build a team of providers. I'll tell you a little bit more about that later, about how that works. But I will also point you to an article that was just published by a medical writer, Dr. Atul Gawande. It was in the New Yorker magazine on the 24th of January. He talked very much about this concept, about targeting these highest risk populations and building a different system of care for them, because the systems that are out there just don't work. I'll tell you about an example of one of our patients who was enrolled in our ambulatory ICU. His name is Jim. In the spring quarter of this year, 2010, He was admitted to the hospital in 90 days, eight times. He was in the hospital 57 days. Charges for that period of time were just shy of $250,000. He was enrolled in our ambulatory ICU, and in the following 7 months, he had only one hospitalization, which accounted for 11 days. His medical costs fell by about 90%. And what's really different about that time period is that he, in the follow-up period, was contacted by our clinic on a weekly basis. He saw someone probably every other week, had phone calls in between, whereas in the 3 months before, he was seen in the ambulatory arena only one time. So we have a team of providers, chemical health workers, social workers, physicians, nurse practitioners, nurse care coordinators that work together on this most complex population. Care is relational. Patients know us. It is intensive. They're seen frequently. It is effective. It is associated with very high level of member satisfaction. Patients love this clinic experience. We've done patient satisfaction surveys, and it's been really quite phenomenal. And Jim is by no means the only patient who's benefited from this model of care. when we look globally at our first 70 patients who've been enrolled, we see a 40% reduction in hospitalization and a 40% reduction in emergency room use. So just to close, I'm going to just sum up and say that we've had obviously a tremendous financial bad deal in CCDS. And I have to say that again because Commissioner Opat wants me to remind you about that. And it's been really bad for the hospital. I don't mean to make light of that. This is a serious financial issue. But turning the financial incentives on their head have really forced us to think differently about what we do. And they've allowed us to invest in things that we haven't invested in before. And so I'm here to say that those investments have brought for the users of Medicaid in the state of Minnesota higher value service, better quality service, better patient satisfaction. They've saved money, lots of money, we think. I think that in closing, I'd like to ask the committee to continue to look for ways to pay us differently about what we do. There is, from last year's statute, enabling legislation that allows Hennepin County Medical Center to contract around total cost of care with DHS around the care of our population in the Medicaid expansion. We'd like continued support for that and look for other ways to be paid differently so that we can continue to invest in novel models of care. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Huntley has a question.
A couple of questions, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Johnson, Hennepin County also runs the social services. Could you tell, it's always been my contention, if somebody's living under a bridge, he's not taking his meds. How did you interact the healthcare system with the social service system in Hennepin County?
Dr. Johnson.
So, thanks, Representative Hunley. We have a social worker on our team. We've had connections with Hennepin County Medical Services, like Hennepin Healthcare for the Homeless. They've been key connections for us. We think about a third of our population is homeless on any one point in time. This is something we're looking for new opportunities to. We have developed some community partnerships with housing advocacy agencies. We think building a safe home is a critical part of making healthcare work better for much of our population. So we have some early efforts in that regard.
We also work very closely with the Minnesota Visiting Nurse Association, who does go under the bridge to help these patients and help with their medications.
Well, Mr. Chair and Dr. Johnson, you talked a little bit about total cost of care and accountable care organizations. Do you think those will work for this population? Basically, that's what you have right
now. Yeah, that's what we see this as a springboard to an ACO, and we're excited about moving in that direction. One of the concerns we have, and I voiced this when we last met, Medicaid is a huge payer for the hospital. It's about public programs are about 45% of our business. And so we want to move slowly, but we really think this is an opportunity for us to provide better value for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. And we have the other three groups as well. So why don't we just kind of work through those, and then I think we'll come back and have time for some questions at the end. So do you want to come down? Thank you very much. And there were four that took this on, if you remember, and they're all four going to offer some things. If you could maybe take about 10 minutes and kind of tell us, we've kind of built the base with some understanding thematically, and so if you can add on your own unique experiences, we're trying to fit all this huge material into a format that people can both hear and then actually digest. So
sure.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Abler and members of the House Health Finance Committee. My name is Marge Page. I'm Vice President for Adult Acute Care Services at University of Minnesota Medical Center, Fairview. The Medical Center, as you know, is a large teaching academic center and part of Fairview Health Services. I'm also the operations lead for the Medical Center's Coordinated Care Delivery System. Thank you for the opportunity to share our experiences as one of four CCDS organizations in the state. Last spring, Fairview stepped forward to be a part of the new and undeveloped CCDS structure within GAMC. We believed really strongly at the time that participating was the right thing to do for our patients, despite the low reimbursement and the incredibly short time frame to prepare. Within a few weeks to plan and prepare, we opened a primary care clinic on June 1st, University of Minnesota Medical Center Riverside Primary Care Clinic, to exclusively serve as the health care home for our CCDS enrollees. The enrollees in our CCDS have very unique and complex needs. Up to 85% have co-occurring medical and behavioral health diagnoses. Approximately 60% have three or more different diagnoses, and 30% have more than six diagnoses. And virtually all of these patients have challenging socioeconomic challenges or conditions in their lives. So to meet the needs of our patients, we evolved a very well-known integrated medical behavioral care model. So what does this model look like? It really involves having a physician and a behavioralist, so this is a trained mental health professional, who assess all new-to-clinic patients and really set the stage for the development of a plan of care that is developed by the patient, the medical provider, and the behavioralist. Physical, mental, and social needs are addressed at each visit. Each patient is treated as a whole person, respectfully, with thorough and cost-effective care. Ongoingly, patients are cared for in a team-based model. So, for example, our medication management therapist may see a patient weekly for a period of time to assist in having optimal medication regimen that the patient is able to adhere to, or the RN care coordinator may follow a patient for several weeks between clinic visits. All of these activities are interdependent, yet utilize the right person for the right job at the right time. The medical center's CCDS utilizes a tight network of providers, largely relying on our partnership with the University of Minnesota Physicians for Specialty Care. All of the care and services are managed through the clinic and provided by referral. And because our patients are enrolled in our CCDS network, we have the opportunity to really manage the care and impact their health for the better. So I'd like to give you just a few examples. One patient is a man with MRSA, which is an antibiotic-resistant infection that had been very, very difficult to treat and was very costly to treat. He had really been ostracized for this condition, feeling that he didn't belong anywhere. The clinic physician and behavioral health consultant welcomed him, told him he was to come to the clinic whenever he had concerns. And with this model, the staff focused not only on his medical condition, but also his depression and his sense of isolation. In one of his many follow-up visits, the patient told our staff that at the first time he came to clinic, he had planned to kill himself. Staff asked him what made him not follow through with this plan, and the patient stated it was because the staff cared about him and helped him feel he was worth something. Another patient in our CCDS is a man with diabetes, chronic pain, and chemical dependency issues. He initially came to the clinic seeking pain medications. Through a team medical behavioral model, staff helped wean this gentleman off his pain medications. Our pharmacist is currently working with the patient to better control his diabetes. Overall, he's made significant strides to turn his life around, stopping his chemical use and addressing significant anger management issues. He's now enrolled at school and has the personal goal of eventually becoming a chemical dependency counselor. The final example is a woman who was in a cycle of admission and readmission to the hospital nine times between June of 2010 and November of 2010. This patient was enrolled in our CCDS but had never really sought primary care, so we reached out to her, convincing her to come to the clinic where the physician and, again, the behavioral health consultant helped to break this cycle of frequent admissions. And the patient has remained out of the hospital since November. I'm personally inspired by these stories and many, many more that demonstrate that the care model and our approach is helping these complex patients. The team we've assembled to care for our CCDS enrollees has really done impressive work to build relationships and deliver outstanding clinical care. We're working hard to quantify our work through quality and cost measures. It's, in the scheme of things, when you think about it, we're very early in this experiment, if you will, but we have some very measures that are very telling. So, for example, we've seen a steady reduction in emergency department utilization by our CCDS enrollees throughout the months that we've been in this model. Looking ahead, we're very supportive of the Medicaid expansion. The expansion will improve access to care statewide, which was a serious issue for individuals covered by CCDS and for whom were living outside the seven-county metro area. We're hopeful that our learnings in the CCDS structure can be applied to other patient populations and that we can continue to serve the majority of our enrollees when they transition to MA on March 1st. In the private insurance market, Fairview has actively pursued shared savings contracts that align the financial incentives to improve quality and reduce the total cost of care. This CCDS model gave us the flexibility to deliver the right care at the right time and to really manage that total cost of care. The traditional MA structure lacks this flexibility and aligned incentives. So we urge the committee to consider innovations in Medicaid that will ultimately improve quality and reduce the total cost of care. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Gottwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Appreciate the testimony. And this is a great insight into what we've actually been able to accomplish in the way of reforming care for a very special needs population. And so I appreciate the stories. There was an interesting dichotomy between a couple of comments you made there late. You said this model is really working and we're looking forward to the early MA enrollment. And by the way, members, this is not an attack on early MA. Okay, I'll preface it with that. And then you mentioned that the traditional MA doesn't provide the kind of incentives you need. So that's been one of my concerns, is that as we move people back now into kind of a medical assistance model of paying for their care, are we going to lose some of what you've been able to accomplish in this new model that delivers better care at a better price point? Or are you going to be able to work with the early MA incentives to keep these people in that model that seems to be working so well?
Ms. Page.
Chairman Abler and Representative Gottwell, thank you for that question. So I would say that the challenge really for us as a state, for everybody, the state payers and providers alike, is really do how we go about aligning the financial and the clinical care model. I think I think you'll hear a common theme today that we really believe that we're doing the right thing and that we can translate some of these learnings to other complex care populations. Obviously, we have other very complex patients that are have other insurances, but we can translate many of these learnings to the broader population that ultimately, I believe, will really help the state and our community and certainly our patients that we serve.
Yeah, and just I'll comment and I'll let you go. And I'm hoping that there's a way that we can capture some of the lessons learned in how we actually pay for the MA programming for the next biennium. Mm-hmm. Rip Huntley has told us more times than not about the Duluth project, where they lose money saving people's lives and keeping them out of the hospital for their heart care. So Rip Huntley Gottwell. Mm-hmm. You're done? Representative Liebling, and then we'll take the next testifying group. Yes. So go ahead, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might have been able to wait for the end. It's kind of but I think this is absolutely the challenge we're facing, and that article that the chair handed out last time, I think, is exactly about this. You know, how do we focus on the people with the high needs that are the ones that we're spending so much money on and give them better care and at less cost? But a couple questions. One is, are the providers that are working on this all on salary? Or, you know, how does the payment to them work? And then the second question, and I guess it's kind of my overall question for all the testifiers today, is kind of to explain, why didn't all the hospitals do this? You know, what was the barrier? Why only four? And maybe it isn't fair to ask these people that did it, but
sure, ask.
But maybe they can help answer that question. You know, what was the difference between you and the outstate hospitals? Because, you know, as was mentioned, this was only available in these four places.
Ms. Page, why don't you take a stab at that while North Memorial comes down?
Chairman Abler and Representative Liebling, thank you for that question. I'll take your last question first. I can only think that it was really driven by the financial model. I mean, certainly Fairview within our own organization had many discussions about this, and although we right from the beginning thought this was the right thing to do, It was a huge risk, and it is a huge risk for our organization. So I really think it came down to that. I don't think it was about not wanting to care for this patient population. I don't think that really even entered people's thoughts. In terms of your question about salary, for our clinic, we chose to open a clinic specifically to serve this population. And so right now our model, our providers are salaried. I think one thing that has really come home for us in terms of doing the right thing for this patient population is because we had the flexibility to utilize our resources the way we could and really use the right person for the right job at the right time. It didn't necessarily mean that a patient had to come in to see a physician to get care. They may have been able to be taken care of by a phone call by an RN care coordinator. And so it's some of those kind of innovations and work processes that are really going to ultimately help this.
Thank you.
Yeah, you can. Thank you. You can thank step you. Away. We'll bring you back at the end of the presentation. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, my name is Jason Rusinak. I was just one member of a team of people who came together to coordinate the CCDS program at North Memorial. I'd like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to share some of our experience with you today. Both Dr. Johnson and Ms. Page have accurately described the business risk and the patient population to you, so I won't spend a great deal of time with that. What I would like to do is share with you four items. The first is just how we implemented the program at North Memorial, some of the successes that we experienced, some of the challenges we faced, and then some of the lessons that we think could be applied moving forward. Implementation of the CCDS program at North Memorial required us to bring together operational and support service leaders from throughout our organization. Starting in early May, medical staff, nursing staff, mental health personnel, business staff from all divisions of our organization, from primary clinics, emergency department, IT department, quality, finance, community relations, and hospital representatives began to meet two times a week in early May to prepare for this program. The team designed and rapidly deployed care plans, communication strategies, tracking protocols, while also identifying the essential specialists and partners in care that would be required to deliver care to this population of people. North Memorial chose to deliver care out of seven sites, seven primary care clinics. Those seven sites were chosen based off of geographic proximity and also their level of integration with our electronic medical record. That was a key tool in tracking and providing communication between providers. Once a GAMC eligible person selected North Memorial as their CCDS of choice, we asked them to identify one of these seven primary care clinics and immediately scheduled them for their first get to know you appointment, and so we could get a physical and history done. Within the CCDS committee, we also developed an internal process for identifying maybe some services, appeals for services that fell into a gray area. There were services covered in the contract that we agreed to provide. There were things that we said we wouldn't provide. But every once in a while, on a case-by-case basis, we had to make a determination as to whether or not a service fell into that category. This team was made up of clinical leaders throughout our organization, quality, and administrative personnel who assessed the appeal based on medical necessity, impact on the patient's life, and coverage under the terms of the agreement with the state. This CCDS committee continued to meet on a weekly basis throughout the program, the duration of the program, to discuss the program's needs, processes, and to continually educate each other on the experience of caring for this population. Now I'll share with you just some of the basic statistics from North Memorial's program. During the past 8 months, we enrolled close to 3,000 individuals. Our enrollment peaked in early August when we were responsible for 2,300 enrolled members. To date, there have been over 4,700 outpatient visits completed in a primary care clinic, with 8,600 visits occurring throughout our organization. Our emergency department completed roughly 1,300 ED visits for North Memorial CCDS patients. An interesting note about this is that about 50% of those occurred in the first 60 days. As the program continued on in the following months, we saw a rapid decline in the amount of ED utilization as people started to get hooked into their primary care clinics. Inpatient admissions and patient days followed similar patterns with reductions each month as the program went on. So this is a good time to transition into some of the successes that came from the program. North Memorial was able to have a significant impact on the location of where services were provided, moving care from the ED into the primary care setting. Just to share one story, we had a patient who presented himself in our ED who had never, did not know what a primary care clinic was, did not know what a primary care provider was. Generations of his family had seen the emergency department as the only point of access for care. Through some very simple education and getting him connected with a primary care provider, he was able to get what was an extensive amount of service that he was using the ED for done in a primary care setting in a more appropriate setting. We were also able to identify frequent and high utilization patients. So we have similar numbers to what had been shared before. About 10% of our patient population accounted for about 70% of the charges that were generated. Included in that, there are some trauma cases and some unavoidable catastrophic illness. But there was a group of this population that we were able to identify who were using services at a high rate in inappropriate settings, and we were able to allocate resources appropriately to meet their care. Another story, we had a woman who was accessing the ED roughly 7 to 12 times a week, obviously multiple times in some days, for mental health and pain management services. Once we were able to identify some of the underlying causes for that, we were able to get her tied into a service that essentially met with her or called her on the phone once every few hours during the day, and really learned that she was using the ED more as a social experience too. She was coming to the ED because she was bored at home. And couple that with mental health problems and then pain management issues, and she was a very frequent visitor to our emergency department. Since we've started that program, she did have one episode where she kind of relapsed and needed some additional care from the hospital, but we have not seen her in our emergency department for the last 7 weeks. Another successful piece, by making the primary care clinic the center of the patient's medical world, all of our specialty services were delivered in a more coordinated fashion. The care coordination process included increased dialogue between our primary care physicians and specialists. In some cases, instead of a referral to a specialist, the primary care provider was able to talk to an orthopedist over the phone, and they were able to discuss strategies that could be deployed in the primary care setting instead of having to go see another physician and start all over someplace else. We also developed more enhanced relationships with community-based providers who have been serving this population for years. Because of the lack of coverage for eye care, dental, things like that, we had to find other providers who were willing to provide these services either at low cost or no cost for this patient population. Despite the successes that we experienced from the CCDS program, there were quite a few inadequacies surrounding the program. In the design and financing of the program, there were a number of things that were left out. Transportation for patients, medical equipment that they may need. Specialty care was really not included. The funding was based on hospitalization, prior hospitalization rates, or hospital reimbursement rates. And as I've just described, a great deal of the care that went towards this population occurred outside of the hospital. Going back to transportation, we had individuals enrolled from 63 counties statewide. Some of that, I think, was because we had a clinic site available in Elk River. So geographically, it gave a little bit more access to the northwest part of the state. 14% of our enrolled population came from areas considered outstate. The cost of transportation for regular visits made this difficult for these people to participate regularly in their care. As I mentioned before, dental and eye care benefits were not included. While these specialties are often overlooked, they are able to detect problems early and prevent some infections and painful conditions that end up in our emergency department. Finally, the funding for this program, as I've mentioned, we feel it was underfunded, and the other programs have all described the business risk that was associated with this. Some of the lessons that we learned and that we feel could be applied as we start to structure the MA program moving forward. Care coordination is really key, putting this population back into a fee-for-service world will create more difficulties, and we'll lose some of the progress that we made. That being said, if we can get this population enrolled in either managed care programs or other ways that we are able to manage access to care and coordinate, build in coordination for care, we feel that that will lead to more successful results. Another key factor to the limited success of the program was the control of funding. For us, we had some success because we were able to allocate resources as we saw fit, instead of a fee-for-service model where you get paid for doing stuff. So we were able to change and apply as we learned on the go and rapidly deploy different strategies. Finally, a successful program will allow us to work closely with ultimately whoever is managing the purse strings for this program to share in some of the cost savings. If we do reduce utilization, it would be helpful to share in some of that benefit, and also track and hold accountable both the providers and the patients for their behavior and participation in their health care. Thank you again for this opportunity, and opening up for questions.
Well, I appreciate the comments, and while we're doing a couple of questions, maybe regions can come down and get settled. Representative Hayden, nice
Thank
to
you,
see you again.
Chair. Good to see you again.
It was a nice thing this morning.
Yeah, it was a nice breakfast this morning. Yeah. Sure was. Thanks for coming to the district. Mr. Rusniak, I just have a couple of questions, a little kind of not directly related to the CCDS system, but in some ways, I know that you guys announced a round of layoffs in, it looks like, 09, 08, and then 2010, and some of that was at least thought that it was due to cuts from funding that you were getting from us. Can you just kind of elaborate on that and talk about where you're at in terms of staff cuts and its relationship to the health department or DHS or lack of funding?
Yeah, I have a chair, by the way. Just pull up a chair, kind of pull up and get comfortable there at the table. And Mr. Rusnick.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, I cannot speak directly to some of the causes for staffing cuts. I was not a part of North Memorial before this year. But what I can talk about is we see and we are seeing a significant rise in the percentage of the population that we treat that is on either Medicaid or Medicare programs. And as that funding is cut, with that, we either have to ask people to work harder and in order to provide the care at the level that we need. And some of that has involved cuts to some services that we had provided.
Representative Hayden.
So, Mr. Chair, so I can appreciate that, but is there someone from your organization that can answer that question? I think that's important. Mm-hmm. For the committee to know and to try to sort out in some sense.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Buck McAlpin, Director of Government Affairs for North Memorial. And Representative Hayden, correct, we have had reductions, probably total, I would say close to 500-plus employees since back to 08 when the market collapsed and we had problems, where lots of the healthcare system was supported by our portfolios where we made investments, and that money was in turn helped care for this population. As that money, when we had the problems in 08, that definitely made a turn. But the loss in the funding, we received about $12.5 million in GAMC prior to this program, and I believe a little over $2 million we received from the program during this 7 months. So obviously, you tie that in as being one of the three level one trauma centers that care for the population that comes from all over the state, whether it's in these primary care model or the acute clinical care where folks come in by helicopters or ambulance 24 hours a day. It's been quite an impact to those facilities.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rusinak, I'm curious, and this kind of goes back to the point of our previous testifier. I'm hearing, you know, the early MA brings us some money, which I understand is an issue. Funding was an issue here, and I think part of the answer to the question why hospitals and systems in outstate Minnesota didn't adopt this was the risk, which I think was testified to. But now that you've got the revenue, however, is coming in a fee-for-service model again, which you've mentioned. Is there a way we can somehow match up the money that's now coming in with the model that you've had, or do we have to do something with that to link up the incentives with the money?
Mr. Rusinak.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, I'm not an expert on how these models are deployed. What I would say is there is unalignment with fee-for-service and the services that were provided through CCDS. Anything that we can do to contract with or work with ultimately whoever the payer is, whether it's a managed care product that is created or the state itself, to share in some of the risk that's taken on. Total cost of care contracting is something that we are working on outside of this population with a number of different payers, and that would be a model that would help us continue the work that we started with CCDS.
And there's one more testifier I want to hear from, and then I think we can have a discussion. If you really want to ask questions of this witness about their specific program, I have Huntley and Murphy on the list. If you want to ask him something about what they're doing right now, then otherwise we'll take up the other discussion at the end. Is that all right? Or Rep. Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but this follows up what Representative Gottwald asked about.
Go ahead.
I think that if we move these people into early MA, the current MA we have will not allow anything except fee-for-service payment unless we go through managed care. And I know Dr. Schiff is out there in the audience, and sometime this summer we're going to start the advanced primary care initiative, which will at least allow medical homes. And I think you ought to have some testimony from them about how we're going to fit this population into what we're going to do on March 1st and what we're going to do on July 1st, and if there are things that we can do to get away from the fee-for-service system, at least for this population, and into a more of a total cost of care.
Yeah,
but I think we ought to have the department come down and not right now, but
yeah, that's appropriate. Representative Murphy, do you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my comment is to Representative Gottwald's question, but I'll wait until after the testimony.
If you're bursting to say it, it's fine. You can wait. Well, thank you. Let's just swap testifiers, and thank you very much for coming. And the conversation we're going to move into after this is highly appropriate and timely and everything. So welcome to the committee. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's do about, you know, we've heard a lot of the themes already, so if you can kind of give us your unique experience. I know it's we had a great tour there, which was productive. And so anyway, go ahead and...
We'll be happy to. We'll try not to repeat what you've been hearing. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Heidi Conrad, and I serve as the Chief Financial Officer at Regents Hospital. With me today is Dr. Jason Robertson. He serves as Medical Director for our Hospital Medicine Program. So I mean to insult no one, but if you don't know what hospital medicine is, those are specialized internal medicine physicians who focus their practice on inpatient medical services only. And so he oversees physicians who practice at Mercy Hospital, North Memorial, and of course our biggest service is at Regents Hospital. Most of you know Regents. We're located just two blocks away. We're a level one adult and pediatric trauma hospital, and we provide a full range of very high quality services. We are a hospital that teaches with about 300 or more residents a year coming through our facility. We also provide training to ancillary staff and advanced practice providers. We are the largest provider of behavioral health services in the East Metro and serve as the safety net hospital for Ramsey and surrounding counties. Thank you for asking us to speak with you today about our experience as a CCDS. As you know, we were the only East Metro CCDS. So with 6 weeks to put our program into place, we were very proud of how our staff and physician partners really pulled together to ensure a smooth transition for our enrollees. One of our first areas of focus was on actual enrollment process. So we work closely with DHS on a proactive process to make sure that patients who are already scheduled for services that were on JAMC, that we had them identified and pre-enrolled in the CCDS program so that their transition would be very smooth on June 1st. And so with our relationship with DHS and our financial counseling program, which is very critical to us at the hospital, played a key role in that. Jason's going to talk a little bit about our clinics and care model.
Thank you. We provided primary care through a number of the...
Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Sorry, Jason.
You have to
Robinson
be made famous.
With
thanks.
Hospital medicine. The care that we provided was through the Health Partners clinic system, specifically at the St. Paul Clinic, the Midway Clinic, Maplewood Clinic, and the Adult and Seniors Clinic in St. Paul. Additionally, we contracted services with the Westside Community Health Center to extend some of our services to other areas. And we also developed a on-site CCDS clinic at the Regents Hospital campus, which coordinated both medical and behavioral health care. And that was something that we had to develop within that quick 6-week period, which was a challenge. The care model that we had allowed patients to move within the system if they found a different clinic was more convenient for them to meet their needs. And we were able to do that sort of thing because we have an integrated medical record system. So there's access at any of the clinics for hospital records or primary care records. We asked our providers to enter orders for procedures or requests for any services into the medical record system. Having that was a way for us to be able to track things a little easier from an accounting standpoint, but also to provide a system where we could review cases for medical necessity. In the vast majority of cases, we found that the care that was being requested was appropriate and medically necessary. And in just a small number of cases did we find that there were actually alternative care models, alternative care plans that were more appropriate from a medical perspective and also less costly. We did have challenges, I think, with a number of patients, particularly early on with entering into our system. With a lack of records, lack of knowledge of their own care. I think a number of patients who were feeling like they were lost to whatever care system that they had been in previously. This led to some challenges with trying to coordinate their care. We didn't have records. There were certainly examples of cases where people have had surgery in a different system and then on an urgent or emergent basis and then weren't allowed to follow up in those clinic systems, which made it a challenge for us to then pick up that patient's care who they may have not had any care for a significant period of time, which is, of course, dangerous for the patient and leads to potential for incurring higher medical costs. And I can certainly talk more about that later. But
we also struggled early on just by the virtue of our system. We were the only CCDS that had outpatient psychiatry available to its patient population. So we saw ourselves early on facing a disproportionate share of enrollment of patients with comorbidities of both medical and behavioral health issues. So we were very thankful for our CCDS clinic on campus that provided that primary and behavioral health services in co-located, you know, simultaneously. But we struggled very much in the beginning finding our psychiatry capacity maxed out pretty quickly. And so I'm sure you're anxious to hear results. But I have to admit, the program's not over. And we didn't exactly think it was going to end until the end of May, so we have just really started our analysis. And actually, as we step back and try to evaluate our data, we're struggling with some of the baseline comparison information. And really on two levels, even CCDS to CCDS, the data, we're going to struggle, we think, with comparison. And then certainly looking at it against the old GAMC performance will be challenging. So let me give you an example. We decided, not better or worse, we just decided that we were going to pay for emergency services provided in other facilities. We felt like, well, not every patient is going to live in Ramsey County. It may not be possible for them to get to Regents Hospital, and so we should cover that service. Granted, it's a paltry payment, but we have been paying other hospitals for emergency services. That's not something that other CCDS has put in their program. So looking at even ED utilization or ED cost will be a comparison challenge for us. And I think one of the general frustrations of the program is who had what in their program. Or speaking to your question of risk, for us, for instance, transplant services was a huge concern. We don't provide transplant services anywhere in our system. So if we would have enrolled a patient who had transplant services, Regents doesn't have a contract with the University of Minnesota. That's clearly where we would have gone to get the care. But imagine for us all the coordination and the financial risk associated with getting $236 a month to pay for a patient who needs a transplant. And so I'm sure some of these systems took a look at the mathematical equation, looked at the services that they had in their system and said, we're simply not capable of taking that risk. We can't put our community at risk, even for what we all hoped would be a short experiment, if you will. And then, of course, we hope that as the state, we can't imagine that you're not all going to step back at some point and ask for an analysis from a state level. We've been providing you as CCDSs with information. But we hope that when you do that, you'll consider not just the CCDS experience, but all the uncompensated care. Excuse me, that's really been spread across our state, particularly outstate, needs to be a part of that picture. There were a lot of people who didn't get into this program and a lot of uncompensated care that happened all across our state.
I think, as others have said, that this program we found to be better than having nothing for these patients. I think that it was better for the patients and certainly helped to reduce some of the utilization of care. But I think that one of the things we have found that when there is only four institutions in the entire state involved and all of them are in the metro area, that becomes very difficult to have a well-coordinated system to deal with these types of issues where there may be specialty care that's only at one particular institution. Or how do you coordinate care that's crossing from one institution to the next institution, and how do you deal with patients who don't live in the metro area? And that was something that we really found to be a big challenge with the program, is the limited number of hospitals that were involved.
Well, thank you. Why don't we invite Dr. Johnson to come down, and Mr. Rusnak and Ms. Page to join at the table to create kind of something of a, see, we got about 10 minutes left, so Representative Murphy, now it's...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's time.
Thank you. And to the testifiers, each of you, thank you. It seems like about 2 years ago we started in this work, and we've learned a lot in Minnesota from this experience that we've all had together. And this was a big bipartisan effort in the end, and very painful. And I recall on the floor saying I had a lot of faith in the providers of Minnesota, that they would figure out how to make something good come out of this, and you have. And the story that you're telling us today about care coordination, intensive care coordination for a really sick population, is an important lesson, and it requires us to take that lesson and think about using scalpels and delicate tools to understand our path forward. Which is hard in the legislature because we don't have a lot of scalpels and delicate tools, but we have to do that. So I want to thank you for that, and I also want to thank you for making clear the inadequacies of what we did with the block grant, which is different than an ACO. So we learn those lessons as well, and we don't repeat them as we go forward in, you know, our efforts to honestly balance this budget. To Representative Gottwald's point, there were two pieces or provisions in House File 1 that we passed in special session on that last morning after that last weekend when we were here all weekend together. And it doesn't seem that long ago, but one deals with Hennepin County and Ramsey County and a pilot project, and the other is a demonstration project, but really it gives the Commissioner of Human Services broad authority to release an RFP in medical assistance. It can be expanded to Medicaid. It can be expanded to Medicare with federal waivers to do this kind of innovation across the systems. That's law. And a lot of our providers already know it. For those of you who weren't here, you should, you know, I can make copies of this for you if you'd like. But there is, thank goodness, we had the foresight to include that language in those last days of our work, because it will give us and the Commissioner of Human Services, along with the provider community, the ability to move forward with these innovations that they've already built on without having to wrestle through a legislative process. And I think that's really good news for us.
Thanks. And I see one of the successes that has been mentioned in each of their presentations is if you compare longitudinal success or experience of some person who was in the program as they went through to the new, more coordinated program, that there was, in almost every case, it sounds like, an improved outcome and an improved cost effectiveness, which perhaps representative maybe Mr. Hoffman will quantify for us if we can export that somehow. So, Representative Huntley, you have a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, and anybody wants to answer, and maybe you could just do it later with some sort of a memo to me, but most of our records in the healthcare system are based on the fee-for-service system, and I think those records are going to stay that way. Is it possible to go to total cost of care or accountable care organizations using a fee-for-service accounting system, and how are we going to deal with that problem?
Who wants to volunteer? Okay.
Well, I mean, I think there's frameworks there, and obviously I probably have a bias being part of a system with a health plan and hospitals and physician practices. So, but the infrastructure to me is there in a insurance physician hospital framework. If the infrastructure's there, it's just a matter of how we want to design it. So, bragging, maybe. At Health Partners, we see our total cost of care data all the time. So we understand, and Jason sees it as a physician leader, how our physicians are performing on a total cost of care. They can see them their own performance relative to their peers, and then we can see our performance relative to other health systems. We might not know their names. It's System A, System B, but we know which one we are, and we can see where we compare, and we can see where we're high. Boy, in this particular case, this DRG, which that's my world, that's how we pay hospital claims, I can see, my outpatient services are lower, but my price is higher. And so then I can work with in our infrastructure team to say, this is a place where we need to get our price more in line. Or if it's utilization, it's a matter of working with the physicians. So, and I think in our community, we're really a lot further along in that dialogue than many other states. We have an advantage. So I think the infrastructure exists. It's just a matter now how we put the pieces of parts together.
I'm now throwing my two cents from downtown Minneapolis. I'm not a health economist, but I have some experience around health payment methodologies and risk adjustment. And just a few comments. I think the Medicare program has struggled greatly with risk adjustment methodology around the sickest of the sick. I think that those methodologies have fallen short around accounting for problems that are endemic in the Medicaid population, such as mental health and chemical use. They way underpay for those problems. So when I think about the question that you're asking us, which really is how do we figure out what a fair price to pay for high-value care is? I think it's a very complicated business. And I'd urge us to move forward slowly as partners and to be transparent about our costs and try to create better care for the recipients of Medicaid here in Minnesota. But we have to continue to have some incentives for the systems to invest as we have in the last year. That's really important. Getting away from fee-for-service as a strict way of paying people is critical. Dr. Schiff's done some wonderful things around healthcare homes, and that's a start. So I don't have a total answer. It is a perilous business, though.
We've got 4 minutes left in this topic, so I have two more questioners, and that'll be, I think this is productive, and I think a lot of this dialogue, as Representative Huntley referred to, can go offline. We do want to find a way to import the lessons, especially between patient in terms of their experience, into the future, even fee-for-service model that we get for the meantime. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this can be, if anybody can answer this, since you are experienced in your own systems on this, but for regions, for example, that your capacity to be a CCDS is quite unique compared to other systems or other hospitals in outstate Minnesota that just can't take on the risk, aren't our insurer. But what insights have you learned that we may want to consider to allow something like this to be able to be expanded outside of the metro area?
Panel?
So I would say that one of the advantages that we have at Regions is being part of a large integrated healthcare system that, where we have a primary care clinics and other specialty clinics in addition to the hospital. And there, transitions of care, I think, are very dangerous times for patients. There are also times in which we might repeat unnecessary tests if there's not good coordination and communication. And so I think that bringing some better work on how do we coordinate care between hospital and a clinic or between a primary clinic and a specialty clinic. Electronic health records are just one piece of that, I think. And, in the metro area, a number of the hospitals are use the same vendor, and we're now working on some programs that help us to be able to share our electronic medical records between health systems, which I think is also going to help to provide better coordination and reduce the cost of care. So a lot of it is, some of it is IT infrastructure, but I think it goes beyond that as well.
Sure. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, I'd just like to point out that integration of electronic medical records, I think, was a key component of the 2008 reforms that this legislature passed.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer, you get the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for all of you. It's just great to hear. I know that as we've gone through all the other testimonies in the last couple of years and working on this, it was really wondering. But I think for me, what I hear most of all is the fact that the patients and the care they got, I mean, that's what we're really all about here, is to take care of them. And to hear that probably one of the greatest successes in this whole thing was that the patients in their care and that, you know, how to deliver that, the flexibility, you know, what do we name it, ACO, CCDS, all the kind of things. I think we can put our heads together for that, and I look forward as certainly the study group, hospital study group, in meeting with you next week and some others as well to like, how can we still keep that patient at the center of it and continue that kind of satisfaction of seeing that and then wrestle with some of these things. And I just know, I mean, there's a lot of smart people over there at that table with a lot of good knowledge, and I look forward to doing that. So it's more of a comment, Mr. Chair, just celebration of those who did have that success.
Well, thanks for coming. If I just didn't chair, I've got a little snapshot here. It's like, you know, four organizations who dared would be kind of the caption. So thank you. We need to learn more from what you've learned, and thanks very much for coming.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Oh, hey, Representative Murphy.
Thanks. As you're getting ready, I think I want to agree.
And so
with the celebration.
Other group, Michael Scandrett, come on.
Thank you.
Go ahead,
but, we have to remember that regionally, rural Minnesota, And, you know, a lot of the people that were once served in GAMC were not served in the CCDS model. So,
hey, don't be wrecking my moment here.
I'm not wrecking your moment. But, no, I mean, really. I mean,
understand. We know
it's
that.
It's a good, it is, but we need to be honest about the limitations, right? And we need to be honest about what was good about it. So I just want to make sure that's on the record. Thanks.
Thank you. And actually, we have to do the minutes. Is there someone who hasn't had a chance to move the minutes yet that feels somehow left out of this? I don't know. Representative Fritz hasn't moved the minutes, I guess. So she'd like to do that. All in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much for that. And now, Mr. Scandrett, you have 30 minutes. We thought 40, but you've, you know, this is another version of the same, you know, some of the same people that we were just talking about. The community health centers have forever found more ways to do more with less, and if it's money or time or whatever. So we have a half hour to learn about what you have to tell us and how you go about your business. And thanks for coming, and proceed.
All right, Mr. Chair, my name is Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, which is made up of a wide range of types of organizations, clinics, hospitals, mental health centers, dental clinics, and others that serve low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged populations. And I'm going to talk for about 1 minute, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jonathan Watson from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. And I think just as a transition from the previous agenda item to this agenda item, I think you've seen a lot of the silver lining of the legislation from last year. And I don't think we're here to be negative, but just to point out some of the things that didn't work as well. And in particular, I think because people had to scramble to put something together and had to do that with too deep of a cut into the total services, there were some problems out there with a lot of community-based providers that could no longer serve their patients, and their patients having to either not get care or to have to go to the hospital to sign up. So there were a lot of concerns there. And what we'd like to learn from the experience is that if we broaden the view a little bit beyond the hospitals and the integrated systems to be sure that we're including the entire safety net community, which isn't always connected to a large system, we'll end up with something that allows people to keep their current providers, get care where at the clinics that are most comfortable for them given their own circumstances and where they live. And this also raises the rural issue, too, of how do we create these kind of models in rural communities that don't have the same types of infrastructure as the metro area. So I'm going to turn it over to Jonathan Watson, and then he'll introduce the other people who will be testifying today.
Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. I'm going to be joined at the table by Dr. Chris Reif and Mr. Steve Knutson that work at two of our member health centers. And what I'm going to try to do real quickly today in 23 minutes is give you a brief overview of what a community health center is. I'm not sure your familiarity with these organizations.
You have 27 minutes. Okay.
27, okay. Take my time. I also want to give you a little sense of how community health centers do make a difference, achieve quality outcomes, and actually save the overall system money. And lastly, kind of piggybacking off the previous testimony, the CCDS and GMC, some of the lessons we learned from that experience. So you all have some handouts, but the basics of community health centers, first and foremost, we are nonprofit corporations. They're locally controlled. That's a key thing. 51% of the board of directors of these organizations must also be users of these. They must use them for their health care. We serve in what's called a medically designated, medically underserved area. That's a federal designation that looks at the number of providers relative to the population. We offer comprehensive primary care that includes medical, dental, and mental health. We strive for that one-stop shopping for the patients we serve. And for the uninsured, which that's 40% of our business, we offer a sliding fee schedule for those below 200% of poverty. We look at their family size and their income, and we charge them accordingly based on their ability to pay. We serve them regardless of their ability to pay. We serve 70,000 uninsured folks in 2010 at the cost of about $36 million. There are 18 organizations that are community health centers, and they offer care at 55 different sites. The history is also an important lesson, briefly. The first two community health centers were started in this country in very diametrically opposed areas of our country, on the Delta there in Mississippi, and a public housing project in Boston. By 2010, there are 1,250 of these organizations throughout the United States that serve 20 million folks. And I think that we received bipartisan support. President George W. Bush he doubled the size of this program. It's part of his legacy. And Senator Ted Kennedy is also a champion of our program. So if you can get those two to agree on one single issue, you must be doing something right. I like the joke. Looking at our locations just in the state of Minnesota, it just gives you kind of an overview here. Up in the Iron Range, we have some sites on the North Shore, the western part of the state, and then in the southern area with our newest health center there in Mankato, Minnesota. In their urban area, not surprisingly, in the areas with the highest poverty, you can see they're in the inner cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I know I'm going through these very quickly, but in terms of our geographic reach, though, we go way beyond our service areas. You know, we're only in 16 counties, but we serve patients from 50% of Minneapolis, of the state of Minnesota zip codes. In Ramsey and Hennepin County, we serve 100% of those zip codes. And what we've seen with the economy and what's going on in the last 3 years is people are losing their jobs or losing, they're becoming underinsured as the companies scale back. They're driving from all points east, west, north, and south to community health centers such as the Cook Clinic in the Phillips neighborhood. So it is a primary access point for folks that do not have insurance. Our demographics tell a great story. On the left-hand side, you see what jumps out at you is 40% of our patients are uninsured, comparing that to the statewide general rate of about 9%, obviously clearly different. And state public programs are a big source of access for public program recipients use community health centers, again, 42% of our patients. Poverty, not surprisingly, translating directly from the insurance status, 97% of our patients have incomes below 200% of poverty, compares a lot differently than the state. And it's also important to just to bounce back that previous slide, but some of our health centers have actually looked at our uninsured and what their status is with employment, and upwards of 90% of the folks that are uninsured using community health center are working in excess of 31 hours a week. So they're just unfortunately in a situation where their employer doesn't offer any insurance, but they are working. Our services, again, we strive for that one-stop shopping. This gives you a perspective of the variety of services we have. The physicians, also employing advanced practice nurses and physician assistants. Dental services and mental health services are also part of the equation at community health centers. Here's where we're gaining market share. Community health centers do a good job of bringing the uninsured into the primary care arena. As you see here, we see about 11% increase every single year. With the changes to GMC, we can talk about this in a little bit. I expect that number in 2010 to be slightly higher. We haven't quite crunched those numbers yet for the entire calendar year 2010, but a dramatic growth year to year. How are we funded? That's always a question I do get as a community health center. Patient-related revenue is about 57%, and we rely heavily on non-patient revenue with that other 43%. But as you can see there, the Medicaid program is a big contributor in Minnesota Care to the financial picture of community health centers. I do want to point out that the foundation, I think it's the top slice of the pie there, they do a lot of private fundraising. 8% of our budget comes from that, collective budgets. And that has really been a tough sledding, if you will, the last 2 or 3 years as portfolios of private foundations have taken a hit. It's a very challenging environment. And also the state dollars there, the 5%, a variety of state grants, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention we do get a community health center appropriation from the Department of Health that partially offsets some of the care to the uninsured. So that's obviously one of our priorities this session. So how do we make a difference? Now we're past the demographics, and Dr. Reif is really going to drill down to this level at the clinic level, but I'm just going to give you kind of a more 30,000-foot level explanation of how we make a difference, and why don't you just start doing that. Improving access, first and foremost, again, this map here, if you can read it, it shades the medically underserved areas, and it also puts where our community health centers are physically located. So we try to locate as many health centers as we can in these shaded areas, and that becomes a challenge at times, but we're constantly striving and looking for areas to begin new health centers. But it's indicative of our patients are coming from those areas for the most part.
Well, Mr. Watson, that chart is also indicative of how you try to stretch everything to fit in available space and budget. So that's kind of a little iconic picture of your work, too. Never mind.
It's part of the job. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Here's another map. It's just the Twin Cities metro area. Hopefully you can read that one slightly better. But again, the medically underserved areas in Minneapolis and St. Paul are highlighted there, and you can see the stars are where the community health centers are physically located. A lot of our patients face transportation challenges, so if it's easy for them to walk or take a bus line to the healthcare clinic, it makes all the difference in the world. Improving access to care, related to this as well, and I don't think we need to get into the words. You can read those studies on your own time, but what blows me away is on the right-hand side when we survey our patients, ask them, do you have a usual source of care? And our uninsured folks that use community health centers, 98% of them reply, yes, we do have a medical home, a healthcare home that is the community health center. In the United States, you ask all uninsured the same question, only 65%. And you ask all privately insured people in the United States, it's still lower. So we mean a lot to the patients that we serve in terms of being a healthcare home and that they use us frequently. We keep them in the primary care mix, if you will. How are we cost-effective? This is a national study. Unfortunately, we don't have Minnesota-specific data, and as an association, we're working towards that. But for Medicaid patients that use the community health center, their mean medical expenditures are 32% lower than a Medicaid patient that doesn't use a health center. And for ER use, they're 35% less likely. The community health center user is 35% less likely to use the ER compared to a non-CHC user. The charts on here just break out different ways of looking at that data by race and Medicaid, uninsured, and income. In terms of quality of care, the Department of Health has come out in the last couple years as part of the 2008 reform efforts with the statewide quality reporting measurement system. It's an effort to measure the quality of care the providers offer here in the state of Minnesota. And for the community health centers, we scored at or above average on 7 out of 12 of those measures. And again, remember, we have 40% uninsured, 92% below 200% of poverty. You know, we're dealing with a much different population that can be harder to serve at times, but we're still meeting these quality targets that are competitive. Patient satisfaction, that always means more as much to me, I guess, but 90% of our patients would recommend the health center to their friends and family. They receive appropriate care. They receive appropriate cultural and socioeconomic care as well, so that really getting back to the patient being comfortable in the healthcare home, they're extremely satisfied with that data. Jobs are obviously a big topic, given the recession that we're living through. Directly, community health centers provide almost 1,100 jobs and $117 million worth of economic activity. This doesn't measure the indirect benefit of that, because I really don't know how to do it. But nonetheless, the medical supply company, there's obviously jobs created from that as well. So there's the residual jobs from that. But this is just the direct impact of community health centers in Minnesota. Again, in terms of reducing disparities, I've brought this chart over multiple times, and here I am again with it because it's always so good. But this is for 2009. This is low birth weight rates by race and ethnicity for community health center patients versus the state of Minnesota. The CHC patients are in the blue, and the state of Minnesota is in the red. We exceed the state averages for everything but every category but American Indians. Again, 40% of our patients are uninsured, and with the poverty that we serve, this is just incredible results that we're delivering. And that's the one beauty, to connect it back to that local control. The American Indian for this year seemed to be a little bit higher. Now the local board of directors of these community health centers can work and say, what are the needs specifically in our community? We live in the community. We know the needs of the community. How do we address this? So we fully expect the American Indian number to hopefully come down in subsequent years. Breaking down barriers to care, community health centers, as part of being a community health center, they have to offer what's called enabling services. And what they do is they enable very hard-to-reach populations access primary care. Examples of this are patient community education, patient outreach, transportation, able to get they actually go pick up the patient, bring them to the appointment so they can receive care. Case management, particularly for folks with chronic conditions, managing the difficult healthcare system on their behalf. And we've seen a dramatic growth in this, our cost for these services over the last 5 to 10 years. I think it reflects we finally figured out these services make a big difference. They're very cost effective, so we need to invest more in them. So summarizing, that's pretty much the end of the demographics piece here, but some of our challenges that we're facing, and there's probably more than four, these are the ones that I think were most relevant, but just the increasing numbers of uninsured, I already talked about that. typically 11% increase. Expect a little bit higher increase in 2010, and it just keeps going up year to year to year. That obviously creates issues in terms of uncompensated care. Fundraising challenges, again, as the private foundations are struggling, maybe rebounding a little bit now with their portfolios, but again, we do rely on them as partners. Access to specialists, for our patients that need further care with specialists, we find it very difficult, particularly for uninsured patients, to gain access to those specialists. And lastly, workforce shortages, and it seems to be getting worse as well. Finding family practice doctors wanting to do work at a community health center, mental health providers, and even on the business operations, as we're moving towards electronic medical record implementation, we need the same level of sophistication from our IT staff as any other company or provider would. So finding those folks and paying them at the rates that we pay as nonprofits can be a challenge. So I just would probably want to, maybe I'll turn it over to Chris Reif, if that's okay for now. Just some of the lessons that I gave a big broad overview. I think Chris is going to look at kind of the on the ground. And I can do this, Chris, while you introduce yourself.
Thank you.
Yep. Yeah, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, my name is Chris Reif. I'm a family doctor. I work at Community University Healthcare Clinic, or called COOC Clinic. It's in the Phillips neighborhood of South Minneapolis. And the main message I'd like to leave you with is the reason that I work there is I think it's one of the best ways to deliver primary care in our city. And I really like to work there. I think we give our patients excellent care. I do understand when our colleagues from the CCDSs were given that huge challenge of how do you take a very difficult population and put them into primary care. And I think they gave a very good testimony about how difficult that is. I'll just say we've been dealing with that at COOC for 40 years. We like to think we've got a pretty good model going, and the results that Jonathan just mentioned shows that we get good quality measures out of it and good patient satisfaction. So I'm hoping this you'll see this as a good news story about there's a way to provide primary care to our group of patients. Where we start with is we would like to think we'd like our clinics to be the kind of clinic that anybody might choose. Yes, we take care of underserved people with a lot of medical problems, but we'd like our clinic to be a place where somebody would choose because it's a good place to come to. So these values are important to us. We welcome people no matter what or in spite of what their insurance payments are. We have ways of doing the payment other ways. And we want it to be friendly to them, whatever their culture or language is. We want it to be accessible to them. We invite them and their family to participate. Patient-centered care has received a lot of attention lately. We've been doing it for a long time because we realize the way people get better the best is that they know about their condition and are involved in solving it. And we also know their patients are, I mean, their families, rather, are a really important ingredient to care, too. So we've been family-centered and patient-centered for a long time, and we think that's important. We also are very fortunate in that we are a teaching site for other healthcare providers, new trainees, students, and residents. So we think that we get to practice good care and also to teach good care. At the basis of what we do is we do primary care. And so we do it in three areas, as Jonathan mentioned. We believe people come to us, as we say, mind, teeth, and body, and we try to give them good mental, medical, and dental care. We have doctors, we have dentists, we have psychiatrists, we have a full spectrum of care providers. Just to remind you, primary care kind of covers whatever you might go to a provider for, so here's a list of them. Again, there's acute problems, chronic problems, family issues, prevention things we pay attention to, and then community issues. And I'm sure all of you in this committee have heard of some of the biggest problems we have going forward, are how do we deal with things like obesity coming up? How do we deal with the mental health problem? We try to solve that within our clinic, and I think we have a good advantage because we have all the providers on site to do it. For example, here's our medical services kind of by account number that we've provided in 2009. And it reads, as you might expect from any clinic that you know of, we deal with a broad range of medical problems. Here are our mental health services, where I think is one of the areas that we excel at. You've heard from the previous speakers that mental health always seems to rise to the top of when you're dealing with patients who are disadvantaged, who have a lot of stressors in their lives. We specialize in this area, especially with people who have serious and persistent mental illness, SPMI, with those kinds of diagnosis. And I think we're rather proud of the fact that we are able to connect with those patients, keep them coming back, keep them connected to us and working on their health and improvement. We also deal with some of the basic problems, you know, of depression, anxiety, ADHD for young kids. So the full spectrum. And here is our spectrum of dental services. And it's, again, as you might imagine and hope for, we get a lot of people in for teeth cleaning, for hygiene exams. You know, we do periodontal work. We do extractions. We take care of all our sealants for the kids and stuff. We like that, too. So you've heard kind of that our population faces a number of different barriers and obstacles to good care. We have interviewed all of our prenatal patients. We do it each year. This is our data from 2008. And just to put some specifics, when we made 240 deliveries, when we asked our moms, so how are you doing in the different areas of their lives, these are the ways they answered their questions. And it is fairly dramatic when you think of the challenge of becoming a new parent, and you add to it, 66% lacked social support or good family support, 40% had housing problems and were moving often, 50% said they had trouble getting to their clinic visits, 26% weren't sure they had enough money for food for the rest of the month, and partner violence, chemical use was all part of the mix. And these are, as I mentioned, very committed patients who are coming to our clinic because they believe in good care. They want to get the best for their, you know, babies. They're being very good. And this is what we're dealing with together in combination. How do we do it? Jonathan mentioned some of this. We have case managers who are very connected to our lives of our mental health patients. We have nurse managers who help us with our special panels of patients, our OBs, our diabetes, our kids. We have the advantage of having a pretty good established computer system now. We're in year number 4, so we use it to our advantage. We send ourselves electronic alerts, develop these panels of patients. We provide classes that are culturally based, so around prenatal care, around diabetes care, around mental health issues. And we, too, have learned the advantages of triaging people early, finding out what level of care they need and getting them to that care sooner rather than later. We also have special programs. We, again, have a preventive services program that's been going now for about a year and a half, where we want to be sure just because somebody has these serious mental illnesses, they're not missing out on any of the important prevention services. And we've been quite successful. We have a Bright Smiles, where we've gotten about 80% of our kids and pregnant moms in with a dental prevention visit. We have our Healthy Kids, where we get them their well child checks and be sure that they're all up to date. So we like that, and we're proud of that. Just to give you an idea, this was a clinic that I had a couple weeks ago. I just pulled out some of the patients that I saw there. My first patient there, just to give you an example, a Cambodian man who happened to come to us for a schizophrenia. We did discover his diabetes and hypertension problems. Any of medically inclined know that those are pretty well managed numbers. We're working with him right now. How can he become more socially active? Because he's doing pretty good mentally, physically, and now he needs to get out more socially in the community. My second patient was an African-American gentleman who got to me through the dental clinic. We check blood pressures in all areas of our clinic. He had quite high blood pressure. We're working on that, and also his smoking, and we got him a flu shot. Another young girl, 2-month-old, Somali girl, came in. I don't know if you know, but there's talk within the Somali community about the high rates of autism. Are they related to immunizations? We have that conversation every time somebody comes into clinic. So we work on that. We also work on the high sugar intake that a lot of the Somali families have, and we're trying to help them with teeth consequences of that and later on diabetes. And finally, my last gentleman was somebody who had insurance up till about a month ago, and unfortunately it combined with him suffering a heart attack, and now he has to get into all of those new lifestyle changes of his diet, taking his medicines, activity, and he's come to us actually, so we've welcomed him and we're well on that path. As I mentioned this, we're doing this, you know, amidst also trying to train the next generation of providers. We're proud to do that. We think that's an important contribution to Minnesota. And this is a list. We see about 238 residents and students each year who are brought into it. So doing all that together, we feel we're meeting quite well our dual mission of good service to the community and also providing the next generation of residents and doctors. We, again, think we do that in a place that's a clinic that we're proud of. We think our patients like to come to see us, and we're happy to be part of the safety net that serves that population. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to give some more testimony?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. Okay. This is Mr. Steve Knutson. He's the CEO of the Fremont Community, the Neighborhood Health Source in North Minneapolis.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
As Jonathan said, I'm with an organization called Neighborhood Health Source. Some of you may know us as Fremont Community Clinics. We're going through a bit of a name change right now, but we operate three primary care clinics in North and Northeast Minneapolis, and in fact are adding a fourth here shortly. And, you know, I just want to, without trying to be redundant to the information you've already received today, I just want to comment on the fact that there's ample evidence that the care models that are used in a community health center, such as the ones you've heard today, both produce a very high quality, high level of care, and they provide a very efficient, cost-efficient pattern of care. And, you know, I think Dr. Reif highlighted many of those key reasons. We have access to many dimensions of care, medical, dental, mental health. We utilize a pretty extensive program of community outreach and patient education, more than you'll see in a typical primary care, independent primary care clinic. We are very good at managing chronic disease of our patients, and that results in, down the road, preventing those chronic diseases from developing complications that wind up costing our system a lot more money when they get when our patients get seriously ill. Our provider compensation, for the most part, is fixed on a salary basis. It doesn't involve production or productivity payments, so that certainly tends to make a difference in some of the utilization patterns that we see. And lastly, and maybe very importantly, we've developed a particular cultural competence in terms of reaching out to the types of populations that our clinics are seeing. And those are skill sets that aren't available at just any primary care setting. So, you know, on behalf of those patients that we serve, our state public program patients and our uninsured patients that we see every day in our clinics, I guess that I would just ask that as you consider and develop your public policy initiatives here and proposals, that you remain mindful of the high quality and the cost-efficient pattern of care that can be made available in a community health center. I emphasize that because I think you should be seeking to move as many patients as you possibly can into a community health center. The patients will win in that equation, and so will our state budget, quite frankly. And I think the evidence is there to support those conclusions. Now, we can't take care of the entire population. We realize that, so we certainly don't represent a single solution, but we could be a much greater part of a solution that's there now. You know, we've seen a little bit here in the development of the CCDSs and what may be coming with the accountable care organizations, and how they have kind of developed. And just to give you a little bit of information about how that all happened, community health centers were basically cut out of that activity. I think there was one CCDS that agreed to participate in some fashion with an existing community health center. All the other community health centers had no options to participate whatsoever. And it kind of leaves me with the impression that we're missing an opportunity, that the design of those programs need to be established so that they can take that into account and take advantage of that resource that we have there right now. We had literally thousands of general assistance patients whose care was completely disrupted from an existing primary care relationship with a CHC. I can tell you stories of elaborate care plans that had been developed for some of these patients in a CHC, only to have that care plan thrown in the garbage and move to the CCDS and start all over again. And I'm certainly not critical of the CCDSs in light of that, but I'm just trying to make sure you understand that as those programs developed, they didn't take into account, I think, the full resource that was available out there in the community.
Well,
thank you.
Yeah, and I there's two questions. First, up's in Gottwald, then up's in Murphy. But I have become persuaded over my time that what you all do is extremely a good value, and I hope there's a way to build on all that in our future work, so I'll leave it at that. Representative Gottwell, and we have about just to keep it short.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'll be brief. I appreciate the presentation. I know we've worked with the CHCs a bit on House File 8 this year. What did we call it last year? 3036, I think. So I think there's a recognition, or at least a growing recognition. I appreciate the fact that you're in front of us. But to get to my question, do you have capacity? I've heard the criticism, well, we can't turn to the CHCs because they're all full up. They don't have any room. And yet I hear time and again that we really need to strengthen the CHCs, you know, both from a reimbursement perspective as well as utilization. Can you address that?
Mr. Watson or Mr.
Yes, Chairman Abler, Representative Gobble. Many of our CHCs do have capacity. I can certainly speak directly for my organization and tell you that we do have capacity. And not only that, but we took existing patients that we had and redirected them to other care sources. So obviously there is some capacity there. No illusions about it, though. We can't solve the entire problem. We can't move all those patients to the CHC world.
Hey, don't wreck my illusion.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwell, too, just so you know, that map was up there earlier with all the gaps. You know, we submitted, I think, eight applications in the last funding cycle to start some new community health centers here in the state of Minnesota. And other states do have a kind of a replicated model called a state-qualified health center that kind of goes the same approach. It's just not federally designated. So there's ways to do that to expand our capacity with new access points, which we're obviously striving toward.
Representative Murphy, you get the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, back to the House File 1, to your point, there in that model that Delivery System Demonstration Project envisions partnerships among clinics, including community clinics. But I think that for the committee, we need to pay attention to sort of the macro changes happening in the healthcare delivery system to make sure that consolidation in the marketplace doesn't lock these guys out.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty good – any last comments? I think that's a pretty good way to end it. Well, I appreciate everybody's attention to this topic and the previous one. I think we're better for it. Thanks for coming, and have a nice weekend. We're adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.